You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Roxana Robinson, whose new novel, Sparta, came out June 4th from Sarah Crichton Books, which is an imprint of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Born in Pine Mountain, Kentucky, Roxana Robinson grew up in New Hope, Pennsylvania. She attended Bennington College and studied with Bernard Malamud and Howard Nemiroff. She received a BA in English Literature from the University of Michigan. She has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the McDowell Colony. She is a critically acclaimed fiction writer and the author of 5 novels and 3 collections of short stories. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's, One Story, Best American Short Stories, and elsewhere, and has been widely anthologized and broadcast on National Public Radio. 4 of her works have been chosen Notable Books of the Year by the New York Times, and she was named a Literary Lion by the New York Public Library. Roxana Robinson has taught creative writing workshops at Bennington College, the University of Southern Indiana, and George Mason University. She has taught frequently at the Wesleyan Writers Conference at Wesleyan University, and she has taught at the University of Houston at Wesleyan University and the MFA program at Hunter College, City University of New York. Roxana Robinson is also a biographer and scholar of 19th and early 20th century American art. Her articles have appeared in Arts, Art News, and Art and Antiques. Her biography of Georgia O'Keeffe was shortlisted for the National Book Critics Circle Award and was named one of the New York Times most notable books of the year. She lectures frequently on Georgia O'Keeffe and appeared in the BBC documentary on the artist. Her biography is considered the definitive work, called by Calvin Tompkins of The New Yorker, without question the best book written about O'Keeffe. Roxana Robinson is a frequent contributor to The New York Times Book Review and Travel Section. She reviews books for The Washington Post, and her essays have appeared in The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe, Vogue, House and Garden, Tin House, Harper's, and other publications. She's also a gardener and a garden writer, and her essays in this field have appeared in Horticulture, House and Garden, House Beautiful, and Fine Gardening. For years, her garden was listed in the Garden Conservancy Open Days, and it has been written about in the New York Times, House and Garden, Traditional Homes, The Atlantic, Gardens Illustrated, and other publications. Here is a brief overview about her new novel, Sparta. Going from peace to war can make a young man into a warrior. Going from war to peace can destroy him. Conrad Farrell has no family military heritage, but as a classics major at Williams College, he has encountered the powerful appeal of the Marine Corps ethic. Semper Fidelis comes straight from the ancient world, from Sparta, where every citizen doubled as a full-time soldier. When Conrad graduates, he joins the Marines to continue a long tradition of honor, courage, and commitment. As Roxana Robinson's new novel, Sparta, begins, Conrad has just returned home after 4 years in Iraq, and he's beginning to learn that something has changed in his landscape. Something has gone wrong, though things should be fine. He hasn't been shot or wounded. He's never had psychological troubles. But as he attempts to reconnect with his family and his girlfriend and to find his footing in the civilian world, he learns how hard it is to return to the people and places he used to love. His life becomes increasingly difficult to negotiate. He can't imagine his future, can't recover his past, and he can't bring himself to occupy his present. As weeks turn into months, Conrad feels himself trapped in a life that's constrictive and incomprehensible, and he fears that his growing rage will have irreparable consequences. Suspenseful, compassionate, and perceptive, Sparta captures the nuances of the unique estrangement that modern soldiers face as they attempt to rejoin the society they've fought for. Billy Collins writes that Roxana Robinson is a master at the work of excavating the truths about ourselves, and the Washington Post's Jonathan Yardley calls her one of our best writers. When I spoke with Roxana Robinson, I asked her to begin by reading from Sparta.
Near the barracks, a low temporary grandstand had been set up. The seats were mostly empty, but kids were running up and down the empty risers, chasing one another. The bleachers overlooked the parade deck, a big square field of scuffed dirt, now partly filled with waiting families. When the buses appeared from beyond the barracks, people began gathering. The buses were unmarked, but everyone knew who was in them. People turned to face them, holding balloons, waving tiny American flags. Homemade signs were raised. "Welcome home, Bobby. We love you, Jesus." Behind the families, towering over the crowd, were inflated balloon figures. A purple castle, rigid pennants fluttering from its turrets, a huge red and yellow smiling bear. They swelled against the sky, weirdly smooth, like giant babies. The bus doors hissed open. The families held back, anticipatory. When the first Marine stepped down, everyone began to cheer. As the line of them appeared, there were claps and calls. Names were shouted out. "Hey, Durrell! Yo, Jimmy!" Mothers waved and called. Children screamed joyfully whether or not they saw Daddy. Wives began weeping. Fathers beamed and whistled. The colonel snapped his hand down at his side. "Welcome home, gentlemen. Dismissed," he said. "Go see your families." At once, the platoons broke lines. The men of Dingo 3 turned and waded into the milling families as though into the surf, the dense marpat brown mingling among the bright colors of the crowd. Conrad swiveled, looking for his parents, at the same time watching the reunions around him. Haskell, a grunt from 3rd Squad, had barely taken a step before he was seized by a beefy teenage girl with heavy arms and long oiled black curls. "Bobby!" she screamed. She threw her arms around his neck, leaning against him and knocking his hat back on his head. Haskell drew back, tucking in his chin, raising his hand to his hat. But she was clamped full on against his chest, and she pressed her meaty lips over his. A group of plump girls in bright tube tops stood nearby, watching and giggling. Private First Class Jackson, 2nd Squad, had begun moving slowly into the crowd when a girl in a red dress came running through it and threw herself on him. She jumped into his arms and wrapped her legs around his like a monkey. It was somehow electrifying and obscene with the small children drifting past. Jackson staggered at the impact, but recovered. He put his arms around her and began turning slowly. Her red dress flared out around her in a rippling circle. Everyone in the platoon knew who the women were. They all knew names, pictures, stories. The beefy girl kissing Haskell was someone he actually hardly knew, a sort of long-distance girlfriend. They'd gotten to know each other while he was in country. It got like that, though, people sending hot emails back and forth to people they barely knew back home. All that testosterone had to go somewhere, speeding out into the internet. Jackson's girlfriend, Helena, the girl in the red dress, had been a cheerleader back home in Oklahoma, and Jackson was always talking about how strong and flexible she was. Jackson ate coffee powder for energy when they went out on patrol, and when he got stoked, you couldn't shut him up. "Cheerleaders, man," he'd say, shouting. "You have no idea. They can do anything. Twist into pretzels. Yes!" He squeezed his eyes shut. "They bend themselves all around like acrobats." After that, cheerleader became code for anyone who could do something extraordinary. Bad guys, Alibabas, which was what you called bad guys, Marines, anyone. And here was the cheerleader herself, doing a flying jump like a monkey, as proof. Jackson was proud of it. That's why he was swinging her in that circle, her dress flaring. He wanted everyone to see it. In country, they talked about women all the time, on patrol in the Humvee, on security, back at the outpost, laughing and lying and sweating and swearing. Once Jackson had impersonated Helena in a dance contest. He came out from behind a curtain wearing an orange towel and white socks, waving pom-poms made out of white paper he'd gotten from the mess hall. They'd all cheered while he kicked, raising his knees and grinning. Usually Conrad wasn't part of those things. As an officer, he kept apart. There was a lot he didn't want to see, stuff he left to the sergeant. But the men had invited him to the dance contest. "The cheerleader!" Jackson had shouted, waggling his eyebrows, swinging his hips inside the orange towel. "Take it off," they'd yelled. "Take it all off." Now Conrad snaked through the crowd, pushing gently past Vasquez. He and his wife had found each other. They stood embracing, locked into each other's shapes. They were nearly the same height, and they seemed fitted together, eyes closed. They were silent, and Conrad looked away to give them privacy. He was glad Claire hadn't come. He wouldn't know how to greet her. How could he not kiss her? For 2 years at college, they'd spent nearly every night together. But while he was in country, they'd broken up, or sort of broken up. Maybe they'd broken up before he left. He didn't know where they were. Were they now supposed to shake hands when they met? When they next saw her, he didn't want it to be in public. Where were his parents? He tried to raise their faces in his mind. Had he seen them without knowing? He saw his father making his way through the crowd. Marshall raised his hand awkwardly to bat at a white balloon that drifted across his face. "Welcome, Tommy," it said. Behind him was Lydia. They were both smiling. Of course, once Conrad saw them, they were utterly familiar, tall and lanky, both slightly gawky. When Marshall reached Conrad, he put his arms around his son. They hugged, shoulder to shoulder. Conrad was surprised by his father's body. It seemed thin and insubstantial. Had it changed, or had he? Compared with the solid, muscular density of Marines, Marshall seemed almost frail. It was not the way he'd ever thought of his father. Conrad turned, and Lydia moved into him, putting her arms completely around him, and he felt the thump of her sob against his chest. When she drew away, there were tears in her eyes, and she was laughing. "I had the craziest idea," she said. "I was afraid I wouldn't recognize you. I couldn't call up your whole face, only parts of it." The crowd was swirling around them, ebullient. Jackson came over to them, his arm around the monkey. He stood apart, waiting politely to be seen. "Jackson," said Conrad. Jackson was short, with a long head and fleshy ears. He had low, beetling brows and gleaming blue eyes, skin mildly pitted with acne. "LT, I'd like you to meet my girlfriend, Helena," Jackson said formally. "Hello, Lieutenant Farrell." Helena smiled at him. She had a very red mouth, loose dark ringlets, a small cleft in her chin. "I'm glad to meet you. I've heard a lot about you." "Glad to meet you too, Helena." Conrad nodded politely, not mentioning that he'd heard about her as well. It was strange seeing her in the flesh, lipstick smudges on her teeth, strands of dark hair clinging to her damp throat. Strange to see this physical manifestation of Jackson's other life. His new life under this darkening California sky, a small evening wind rustling the leaves overhead. Strange to think that this was the last time he would see Jackson in this way. The balance had already shifted. Jackson's arm was around the monkey. His allegiance was now to her, or to whoever came after her. He'd never again be under Conrad's command. The last 4 years were being dismantled around him, subsiding, melting away in a silent cascade. Their shared life was over. From now on, for the rest of their lives, they would share only a past, never the present. It was as though Jackson himself were vanishing before his eyes, though what they shared would always be there. Part of their life was fluid, part fixed. "All right, Jackson, have a good evening." "You too, sir," said Jackson. Conrad thought of the monkey's legs wrapped around Jackson's waist, that graphic, flamboyant welcome, the public declaration of a different life. He thought of Claire. Everything was breaking up and changing.
Thank you so much for reading that. That was great. I guess my first question is, how did you come to write a book about this subject, and particularly about Conrad and a Marine returning home? What was the inspiration for getting this going?
The first moment of it, when it sort of entered my mind, it took place because I read an article in the New York Times, the front page, about, and this was maybe 6 years ago, and it was about the fact that the Marines were, I don't even know if it was Marines, but the troops were over there, and they had been given unarmored Humvees, and they were driving around on patrols and being blown up by IEDs. And they were suffering something called TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, because of the explosions. And TBIs are hard to detect and hard to diagnose. And because of the sort of battlefield ethos, people were reluctant to report them. And so they were they were still in combat, having suffered these TBIs because of the explosion, because of the way the battle was being fought. Mm-hmm. And the military was reluctant to diagnose them because it meant if somebody did have a TBI, they would lose that person from the battlefield.
Right.
And because they're very expensive to treat, and so is PTSD. And I was so horrified at the thought that we were meant to be the greatest military force in the world, and we had put these troops out unprotected with old-fashioned and inappropriate gear, and putting them in a situation in which they were relentlessly being blown up and then refusing to acknowledge the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so troubling to me that I didn't think at that moment, I have to write a novel about it, but I did think, I have to learn more about this. And I started reading everything I could find, and it was more and more troubling. And that's what happens. It just gets into your head, and it becomes something you have to explore in that way.
Now, do you find that there are subjects that you start to read about and you really feel this incredible pull to know more, and it's not because you're eventually going to write about it? I mean, does that happen very often? Or do you think maybe right from the start this was a subject that was bound to turn into a book for you?
Really, the way I come to write a novel is that I find something that's part of my world that I find so troubling that I have to explore it. And and that's been the case with all the books that I've written.
Yeah.
It's not that those are the only issues in the world, but those are the issues that have moved me the most powerfully.
Right. And I remember your last book, Cost, was about heroin addiction, which was another one that just really was very chilling to read. I mean, there was a lot I learned reading that book, too. I wanted to ask you a little bit about doing the research for Sparta. Who did you talk to, and how did you find people? And also, did you come up against much resistance to your questions?
Really good questions. It was very, very difficult for me to break the barrier that exists between the military and the civilian world. And the military is very tribal, as one of the Marines I finally talked to told me. And very insular, and they are very proud of their own, creating their own culture, and they are reluctant to share it with, to allow civilians inside that world. So I had thought that I would have trouble finding people because I don't know many people in the military, but hadn't realized the power of the resistance that exists. And so I did run up against that, and I think it was partly because I'm a civilian and partly because I'm a woman. I offered a number of times to teach workshops to returning vets, and I was always turned down. But I finally made contact through writing with another vet who had written a book, and through him, I also reached a vet's website, an organization that has a website, and I asked them to post on their bulletin board, which I did not have access to as a civilian, but they posted it for me, and I said who I was and what I was doing, and I got a number of responses from that. But it was mostly this writer who put me in started a network, and then, you know, vets responded to me, and then they put me in touch with other people. So I did create a group of people that way, and then I was very conscious of this charged barrier between me and them. And I sat next to a man at dinner one night at a literary event, and it turned out that he had been in the Marines, and his son had been in the Marines and had been in Iraq and had fought at Fallujah, which was a really important battle there. And I said, "Oh my gosh, I'd really love to talk to him." And it was as though he had turned on a dry ice laser. He looked at me and said, "That is up to him. I would never, ever offer you the invitation to interview him. You would have you'd have to talk to him." And so it was like applying to Harvard. I had to write an email explaining who I was and, you know, making myself sound, I hoped, irresistible, and sent it to him. And then he forwarded it to his son, and after a while, I heard back from the son who agreed to talk to me. But, you know, it was very clear that this was a very serious issue of whether or not I would be given access.
Right.
And
yeah.
Then once I did talk to his son was really wonderful and read my manuscript and took me to Quantico, which was a great moment for me, and became a good friend, and he's still a good friend. But getting there was very difficult. But once right. I got to them, they were really wonderful, generous, open, trusting. The interviews I had were just wonderful.
Yeah, I would think his father, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing his father was protecting him rather than protecting the Marines, don't you think? I mean, he probably has, I'm sure that sometimes the media comes with this sort of agenda to talk to people. And it's a little bit dangerous to talk, do you think? Or
it's very much dangerous to talk, and particularly to a novelist, because you can at least... I once was at the airport in Bangor, which is one that I use myself, and it was a place where the troops returned. It was their first landfall when they mm-hmm. came back from Iraq. So I saw troops there all the time during the war. And I went up to them at one point and said, could I talk to you? I'm a writer. This was a woman. She was a medic. And she, again, it was just like a blast of cold air. She said, who do you write for? And I said, well, this is really it for a novel. And she said, no, I'm not talking to you. So it was, you know, for a novelist, you have no control. At least if it's a journalist, you know that they may have an agenda, but at least they're trying to get the facts right, and they might be on your side. They probably
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
But for a novelist, you have no control. You have no idea what they're up to. And
that's true, yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, in the narrative of Sparta, early on you share Conrad's memories without necessarily explaining them. You know, sometimes you'll put in a line of that shows us into his mind without explaining it. So, for example, he thought of the woman with the basket, Olivera whispering, the dog, the brown streets of Ramadi, the blowing trash. It's a recollection that mimics the way the mind does work, you know, sort of throwing out images and random memories. But it also draws in the reader and sort of promises a story. It's a way, I think, of getting us involved in the larger narrative. So I'm wondering if you can talk about doing this and timing it so that the story unfolds in a way that's pleasing to the reader and helpful to the reader.
Well, that kind of thing, I think, is instinctive and intuitive in a writer. It's really the way my own mind works. I don't have any kind of formula. I don't go back and put them in. Once I'm inside a character's mind, I really feel as if I'm thinking with them, that I'm thinking as Conrad thinks. And so it is his mind, and he's troubled by his memories, and he can't go get through the day without returning to Iraq over and over.
Right.
And so those are the things that I did so much research. I watched so many films about Iraq. I watched it on YouTube. I watched firefights on YouTube, and which are, you know, taken by video by guys in a Humvee in the streets of a town in Iraq. So it became quite vivid to me.
Yeah.
So his memories became part of the life I was living at that
sure.
while I was writing it.
Yeah. When you write something like Olivera whispering, did you already know what that scene would be, or was that just like, okay, this is where it's going, and I, as the author, don't yet know exactly what that will look like, but I feel like this is important. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Let's see. Yes, I did know what Olivera whispering was about. I did
okay.
know what the dog was about.
Right, right. Okay, all right. So this is something I was going to ask you a little later, but since you just brought it up, I feel like writing this book would have been hard, and doing all the research, and as you're saying, watching these films, I almost feel, and I don't mean to sort of trivialize what these military people go through, but I almost could imagine you finding yourself undergoing some PTSD-like stress in writing the book, you know, like being awake at night and haunted by these these images and stories. Is that at all true, or am I imagining?
Yes, no, yeah. Absolutely, because they really took over my life. It became very, very powerful. And there was an organization called Winter Warriors, and they gave testimony. They're opposed to the war, and they gave testimony in Washington, and those are on video, and they're also published in a book, and those are incredibly haunting stories. And it was just so sad hearing these stories and hearing what the troops had to go through. It was like living somewhere else while I was writing it.
Talking again a little bit about the structure of the book, the part that you read for us, chapter two, that was an excerpt from chapter two, and what we didn't see so much from the full chapter is that you also show us Conrad's parents waiting to meet him upon his return from Iraq, and you also included a flashback to before he went to Iraq, when he announced to them that he was planning to join the Marines, and I thought that was really useful because you know we got to see what their life was like as a family before, and then we see him come back and we see what it's like after. So I'm wondering if we can talk a tiny bit about writing flashbacks and how you decide if a flashback is valuable in the narrative, and to what extent it might be a detriment to the narrative to do too many flashbacks, for example, or something like that.
Again, for me, it's intuitive. I mean, when I sort of feel as if I've written everything I have to say right now about this passage, then I want to turn to something else. And I have to hope that the reader feels the same way I do about both these things, that he or she has had enough of this subject and is ready to move on. Mm-hmm. So it's there again, there's no sort of formula that I use. Right. I do think flashbacks are kind of inevitable. There's no way to stay entirely in the present in a character without making the character opaque. We can't know enough about somebody only following her in the present moment. You have to know about the past. And this particular issue is so powerful because this family, Conrad's family, was not military. This was a complete bolt from the blue for them. And it's not uncommon, I learned during my research, that a lot of families like this who had no military background were suddenly informed that their sons, mostly sons, were going into the military. And so this was a tremendous shock to the family culture. And it was really interesting to me to understand how families would deal with that and why the sons would be driven in this direction. So that had to be a part of the narrative because the book is about Conrad trying to re-enter the civilian world, trying to fit back into his family, trying to fit back into his life, and being unable to do that. And that's not going to be powerful unless we have a sense of what it was like before.
Right. The discomfort that's between them after his return is just excruciating. Discomfort between himself and his parents, his siblings, his friends, his girlfriend. There's this terrible divide between Conrad and everyone else, and they're all trying so hard to understand each other, and they can't. It was just so sad, and it felt very real to me. And I wondered how you approached this, and how you kind of accessed the way that must be for these families. It just felt so real. I'm just curious.
Well, there was one particular interview that I did that was very, very striking for me. I was struck by the fact that everyone I talked to was unable to express how this worked for him. That they would, you know, I'd say, how was it when, what was it like when you came home? How did you talk to your parents? And their faces would just cloud over. Mm-hmm. And they would say, I couldn't talk to my parents. And one of them said, my father, there was a picture of this man who taken next to Petraeus. He was a captain, and he was, Petraeus had come to where he was serving, and they'd taken a photograph. And his father said, why don't you hang that picture on the wall? Why don't you put that in a shadow box and hang it on the wall. And he said, I didn't know Petraeus. We weren't friends. We weren't buddies. This was just taken because I was there. And his father said, yeah, but why don't you hang it on the wall? And he said, I can't explain to my parents how their picture is so different from my picture. I can't, of my life there. He said, I can't talk to my parents about this. He said, I can talk to you, which I felt so grateful for. But I can't talk to my parents about this. And another one, another vet told me about, I was talking to him with his wife. The two of us were in their house. And I said, why did it feel so strange coming back? And he started describing going to his cousin's wedding and standing at the reception afterwards with everyone, singing and drinking and dancing. And his face just crumpled. And he said, I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand being there. And his wife was watching him, and she started to cry. And he couldn't explain it. And his wife was so attentive and so responsive, and it was just devastating to watch this.
Yeah.
And to see how powerful the divide was, and how it was not something that anyone could express. There was no way to express it. It's simply that they had been in a different world, and they couldn't re-enter this world, and no one on either side of it could reach across the gap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very, very powerful in the book, it just felt like a kind of not obvious truth, but something that made perfect sense, and yet people who aren't experiencing it might not have thought about it before. And then you read the book or you read an account of this sort of interaction, and it's like, of course that would be difficult to come back. You had one line in the book, it was a question of getting through the moments. I thought that was so spot on. It just must be like, I'll get through this moment and then there will be the next one. And the other thing that really struck me was how hard it was for Conrad, your character, to ask for help from anyone outside of his universe. To share his experiences, there's another line in here. Let me see if I can find it. It was like betraying. It was like betraying his men to share these experiences outside of their universe. Here it is. Admission of fear was betrayal of trust, and shame was the punishment for breaking trust.
Yeah, the military ethos, particularly among the Marines, is very powerful, and it really denies the possibility of admitting to fear, because that's the central issue on the battlefield. If you if you admit to fear, it's over. You can't really fight. So that the whole drive is to become trained in a way so that you do things automatically. You obey orders and you do what you have been trained to do, and you don't allow yourself to be afraid, because that will destroy everything. So that works very well on the battlefield, but coming home, it's completely destructive. Because you're not given any way to acknowledge it. There's no way, there's no safety valve once you're back.
Right.
It's still not admissible. So people are trapped with that fear, and there's nowhere to confess it.
I was wondering, to what extent did you feel you had to educate your reader about the war in Iraq and the history of the region and sort of post-9/11 politics?
Well, again, it's intuitive, and I sort of use myself as a role model. I mean, just as sort of every man. I realized I didn't know a lot about it, and so, and particularly as these events faded from public consciousness, I started the book 5 years ago, and I think people were then more conversant with things than they are now. So I just included a lot of information that was information I found particularly interesting and that would allow people to have a sense of what it was like to be there and the reasons for that, why the Iraqis were so angry, the way they chose to make the to fight against us the way we chose to fight against them. I thought all that was really necessary in order to inform the reader.
Right.
So the risk was that it feels kind of didactic, and I just chose to insert another voice into the narrative, just as an explicator, and just to say here's how it is, because I needed to talk about Sparta itself,
right,
in ancient Greece, and I needed to talk about Fallujah, so I just decided to do that. In cost, I was able to give a lot of information through the voice of the interventionist, explain to the parents a lot about addiction and heroin. But also I put some of that into the mind of the mother in cost, who says she'd learned a lot about the addiction in the past months, and then I explain what some of the things she'd learned. But there are things in a book like this, in any book that has a particular world that has a lot of particularities, kind of information that's particular to that world, you have to choose. Are you going to educate the reader in ways that they might not, in directions that they might not have already gone, or are you going to let it be opaque? And I wanted to allow the reader to know more about the world.
Right. I thought it came off very well. I mean, I think you're right that the danger is that it will be, you know, sort of didactic, as you say, but it didn't seem that way to me at all, and I think that's why I asked the question, because it was very well balanced, and it was informative. I mean, there were things that, even if we've known them in reading the newspaper, we don't necessarily carry them in our minds every day, so it was helpful to have that history put in here while we're reading about Conrad. I do have a question, though, about as you were working on the book, and I don't want to talk about the ending, but I wondered if you were at all concerned about the political implications of the right or wrong ending to a story like this. I would feel like it's hard to end a story like this. You know, he's struggling, and you know, do you want a happy ending? Do you want a not happy ending? And what constitutes a satisfying ending? And politically, is there any sort of pressure on you to end it in a certain way? So I just, without actually talking about the ending, I wonder if we can talk about thinking about these things.
Yeah, the politics are interesting. I feel, I mean, so many vets have had so many different experiences. There is no one experience that everyone shares.
Right.
So I talked to one Marine, and I said, did you feel betrayed by your command? I mean, there were no weapons of mass destruction, and you went in there and you lost members of your platoons, and did you feel betrayed? And he said, honestly, and this was an officer, and the officers seem to have a better time of this than the enlisted men, but he said, no, I didn't feel betrayed. He said, honestly, it's sometimes in a man's life, in a young man's life, he wants to go to war. Mm. So he felt completely his own agent, and that this was his choice, and, you know, wars turn out always differently from the way people expect. So I felt that I had a lot of leeway, that I could end it the way each man's story would be different.
Right.
But I have been asked already if this is a deliberate indictment of American policy, and in some ways, I'm pointing out the fact that we didn't really support the troops in the way that, in several ways that they needed support. We didn't give them the right equipment at the start, and we do not count the costs of rehabilitation into the cost of the war. And so we can spend millions and millions of dollars on stealth bombers while we try to avoid diagnoses which will cost the military a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it's amazing because at this point we're hearing that the Pentagon is saying they do not need some of this equipment that's being budgeted for, and it's being pushed through, and that money would have been so much better used toward the mental health of these men and women.
Yeah.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned Sparta, and you mentioned the mythology behind Conrad's motivation to go to Iraq, but also behind the title of the book. He's so inspired by history and mythology, and I loved that before going to Iraq, that's sort of, he's very romantic about it all. But afterwards, he's so ill and depleted that he can't even bring himself to look up at the ceiling of Grand Central Station and see the heroes and gods that are painted there that once, you know, moved him so very much. I thought that was a really wonderful moment in the book. So I wondered how you came up with the whole idea of his being motivated by Sparta and the history and mythology.
Well, I was fascinated. Once I started reading and looking at sources and looking at first-person narratives, there was one... There's a book by Nathaniel Fick called One Bullet Away, and he went to Dartmouth, and he was a classics major. And he was really the source of my thinking in that direction, that I was so fascinated that somebody would make this connection between the classics, which are many of those authors wrote about war, and war was the great thing for a man to do. It was a central issue. So then I started doing more research about Sparta, which was an extraordinarily interesting culture itself. And the Marines identify very strongly with Sparta because they were such great soldiers and had an ethos that was so dependent on loyalty and bravery and discipline. And the more I investigated Sparta, the more interested I became in it and of the connection between them. And the Marines do name their combat outpost Sparta. They use references to Sparta often. And when I learned that the combat outpost that was lived in by the Marines in Haditha, where a real-life horrible civilian massacre took place, in which 24 civilians were killed, and the outpost that they lived in was called Sparta, and I just thought, this is so powerful, this connection, that it's going to inform the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you mind if I read a little paragraph from the book and ask you about it?
Yeah.
He's thinking about the fact that people read gossip magazines, and that while he was in Iraq living through all the horrors that he lived through and everybody else lived through, people back here were reading trashy magazines about movie stars. So here's the paragraph. They'd all been reading this stuff here while his men were over there in country, getting up in the dark, clumsy and tired, covered in sand, loading themselves with 60 pounds of gear, fear clogging their chests, checking the springs on the magazines, buckling on helmets, getting ready to mount up and head out, ready to be blown apart, actually being blown apart. Everything over there had happened, real things, while people here were reading this stuff, feeding on it. That was such a powerful paragraph, and it was such a... it just made me very sad because it's so true. And I just wondered if anybody talked about that or if that's something that you thought about how that would be frustrating to you if you were this person.
It just was part of the... Nobody that I talked to talked about that, but as I was in Conrad's mind and moving through his day and encountering different things, there was this constant feeling of contrasting here and there. So this was the kind of thing that it's one of the consequences of an undeclared war. In World War II, the whole civilian community was engaged in the war, and people had maps up in their kitchens, and they moved thumbtacks when the troops moved, and they collected tinfoil, and they had victory gardens, and the war was on everyone's mind. They knew where all the troops were. They knew where the lines were. It was really, really important. And furthermore, every family was touched by it. Every family had somebody over there. Right. And in this war, it was undeclared. It was unofficial. No one knew why we were there. It turned out we needn't have been there. And most people were unaffected by it. So there's this... That's a cause of grief for the vets, that they were there offering their lives and sometimes having their lives taken, and people over here were just completely indifferent, didn't even understand it was happening.
Right. And it's almost as though putting that yellow magnet on your car makes you a part of it.
Right.
You know?
Right. Exactly. I did what I could.
Right. Another part of the book that talks about reading things. Early on, you have Conrad trying to read a thriller that he's bought in the airport on his way home. And he's having trouble concentrating on the book. And it's really because of his PTSD and all he's going through and all that's on his mind. It's not specifically about the book. But he also thinks about how meaningless the words are. So I have two questions about this. First of all, I'm assuming you wrote the paragraph that's included there for us to see what he's reading, and I was wondering how it was for you to write that sort of, you know, kind of trashy espionage scene.
It was really fun.
Was it fun?
I had really a good time, and I thought, this, I could go with this.
That was funny. And then my larger question about that same thing is, you know, do you think that all types of fiction are valuable? Do you think that even the kind of trashy novels that people buy in airports have some value? Or do you think that certain types of fiction do rob us of truth in some way?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, I certainly don't only read great fiction. I really like detective books as well. I'm incredibly picky about them now. There are some
right. I mean,
I
there are great detective books.
Yeah. Tana French is my new favorite.
Oh, yeah, she's great.
She's wonderful. But I think it's completely personal and individual that you read great books because they challenge you, and you read minor books because they comfort you or they give you some kind of peaceful. They deliver some kind of content that is useful for you to have. It's kind of like eating popcorn or something. I do tell my students when I teach, don't read bad writing. And I don't like, I won't read bad writing because I think it gets into your head. The sentences get into your head. It's not that the stories are necessarily bad. It's the writing. And I think that's, for myself, that's something I don't enjoy at all as a reader. So is it bad for you morally? I don't think it's bad for you morally, but I wouldn't read bad writing.
Okay, great. I just have a few more questions for you. What are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on a story. I've been writing a number of stories since I finished Sparta, but I have started another novel, but I don't ever talk about them while I'm writing them.
Okay. All right. That's fine. But you said it took you 5 years to write Sparta. Is that kind of typical timing for you? Does it take you years to write a novel?
It does take me years. With each one, I think, okay, this time I'm going to write it quickly.
Yeah.
My first novel took me 7 years to write, although I was writing other things. I was writing stories while I was writing that, but it took me 7 years. Then the other novels have taken me 4 years each, and this one took 5.
Well, that's that's a relief to me, because I feel like sometimes you hear about, you know, Stephen King puts out a book in 4 months, and that's what we should all be doing. It's like, no, I can't possibly.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it takes longer. This took me particularly long because it was so difficult to do the research. I realized how fortunate I had been with cost, because I didn't know really anything about the world of hard drugs and addiction. And it was lucky that AA meetings and NA meetings are open, so I could go there and listen to people, and I was very careful never to betray any trust. And when I talked to people individually, I told them exactly what I was doing, but it was a way to understand that world that was open to me, and
right.
There was nothing like that in the military, so it took me a long, long time to get any kind of access to people. And also, there were other problems with this book, so it took me a long time. At one point, I threw out 300 pages.
Oh, my goodness. Did you then go back and call through them for just a few paragraphs here and there?
No, they were gone.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was the wrong voice. It was the wrong voice, so I had to pretty much start over. So this book was challenging in ways that I hadn't experienced before.
Yeah, it's, you know, though, it's so paid off. I mean, whatever you had to go through to write this book was so paid off. It's just, it so touched me. So I was going to ask you also, what do you read, what do you like to read, and who are some of your favorite authors?
Well, I'm teaching this semester, so I've been reading books that I know and love, this semester I taught Madame Bovary, Anna Karenina, To the Lighthouse, some Chekhov, and Willa Cather's My Antonia. So those are all books that I love and reread and I'm very happy reading for different reasons. And I also read, I was asked to introduce Cheryl Strayed at a reading at Hunter, so I read all three of her books. I had already read Wild and I loved it. Mm-hmm. I love her writing because she is so brave. She's really fearless about kind of the violence and the chaos of the heart, and she's completely unwilling to embrace irony or distance. She's just fearless about engagement, which I think is really an impressive way to write.
Oh wow, okay, that's interesting. And now I want to go back and read her again, thinking about that.
Yeah, she's it's not fashionable. Irony is much more fashionable, and she just. But irony keeps you at a distance. It prevents engagement, and she just says, "This is what's important to me is engagement."
Yeah, yeah.
So I really admire that in her. And other than that, yeah, I'll read a ton of French. I'll read books about nature. I'm a big nature freak.
Yeah.
I read at random. Right now I'm reading James Salter's new book.
Okay.
Very beautiful.
All right, I just have one last question. It involves me reading another paragraph. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, sure.
This is a paragraph from late in the book. Conrad is trying to explain something about his experiences in Ramadi and Haditha to someone. I won't say who. But I just want to just read this paragraph. Spoken out loud here in the cinder block room, the words seemed tiny and insignificant. He paused, trying to find the words that would make the event what it had been, that would give it the size and significance it still had in his mind. But the words had nothing to do with the way the black flower of sound had bloomed inside his head, the way it kept on blooming over and over, blotting out the world. I thought this was just an incredible paragraph describing what Conrad's going through, but also describing how hard it is as a writer sometimes to talk about or write about the most significant events, the really personal events. So why is that harder to write about? So I thought maybe we could end by talking about that a little bit.
Well, that struck me really because I was talking to a much older man, a man who'd been in World War II, and he was talking about how they had been celebrated recently, and they'd been called the Greatest Generation, and obviously it made him proud, and it was gratifying to be called that. And he told me about, I think he was telling me about having shot somebody, and then he'd gone around, and how traumatic that had been, and he'd gone around behind a building and vomited. But the way he described it was so brief, and so it was insignificant. It didn't really sound like anything, but clearly it still meant something to him. Mm-hmm. And it just struck me that this is really part of the problem, is that there's no way, once you reduce these experiences into simple words, there's no way to present them in the way that they still are for you,
mm-hmm.
and that must be part of it. There's no way for a civilian to understand that experience. Just there's no way for somebody to understand what it felt like when you almost drowned that time in the swimming pool.
Right.
You say, I went underwater, I couldn't breathe, but those do not convey how you actually felt. So this would be the big thing. And I did talk to vets about that. One vet said to me, starting out the conversation, he said, something happened on April 3rd, 2005, which I will never tell anyone. And I thought, what could it be? Of course, I wanted him to tell me. He didn't. But I thought, what could it be? And then I thought, actually, I have read so many accounts of things that happened, so many horrible things, that it's got to be one of them. Mm-hmm. And it's simply part of human experience. It's just the fact that it's indelible in his mind, and he can never express what that was. And so that became part of this.
Yeah. Now, I won't ask you specifically what your own experiences might have been, but did you have things that you drew on from your own life that helped you write about the feelings of disconnection and the difficulties of expressing these things for Conrad and for the military, you know?
Well, I think that all writers draw on their own lives, but it really has to do with empathy. And Chekhov was the greatest example of this, writing about every kind of person in Russia at that time, peasants, women, aristocrats, doctors, every shopkeepers. He could be in bishops. He could be inside anyone's mind. Mm-hmm. And I think that to a greater and lesser extent, that's what all writers are trying to do. Of course I understand what it feels like to feel like an outsider. Of course I know what it feels like to be unable to express your feelings to someone. Of course I know what it feels like to feel distant from my family. We all know those things. Mm-hmm. So it just means expanding them and saying, what if it were worse than this? What if it were really, really impossible? So it's entering a room you've already been in. It's just finding that room is larger.
Okay. This was great. Thank you so much for speaking to me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I did too. What a pleasure this has been.
That, once again, was a conversation with Roxana Robinson. You can learn more about her work at her website, roxanarobinson.com. And her first name is spelled with just one N, R-O-X-A-N-A, roxanarobinson.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Roxana Robinson. The first exercise that she always offers to her students is this. Write one single page, no more, do not go over, just one page, and include two voices and a conflict. And have no description, no exposition, just dialogue between two voices that have a conflict. She says that what comes from this setup is always very interesting, and it always intrigues her to see that writing only dialogue with a conflict, the writer naturally will supply everything the reader needs to understand without any exposition, and it's a great exercise. So good luck with this week's Write the Book prompt, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. Next week, I am going to air an interview with the author Lewis Busby, who I interviewed thanks to a listener request. If you have a guest to suggest to me, or comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.